Welcome back to another episode of the D'Antonio Wingcast. This is Ben from Blazers Edge, and I'm here with Kevin Pelton. Kevin, we made it another week without Kevin Pritchard getting fired, so we should probably just take a moment to celebrate, shouldn't we?
Is that going to be a celebration as dramatic as the New Jersey Nets celebration of their 10th win last night?
No, they were like fist-pumping like champs, like going off clapping high fives with all the crowd. I mean, the poor Spurs just looked like they were going to commit suicide, a group suicide, you know. The locker room drank some Kool-Aid with their sneakers on. I mean, it was just what a ridiculous performance from San Antonio in a must-win game. I mean, that dropped them a half game behind Portland. Now they're in the eighth spot. Now, they're not obviously going to miss the playoffs, but they just went from playing, you know, potentially Dallas or Utah to facing off with L.A. in the first round. San Antonio doesn't want any part of L.A. Would you agree?
You know, I thought that Matt Moore raised an interesting point where he was like, if San Antonio is going to have to play L.A., and they basically are, maybe it's better for them to play them early when the Spurs are relatively rested. I mean, the big thing with the Spurs last night is, you know, no Manu Ginobili. He's been carrying that team the last couple of weeks.
Is he even going to be in the NBA next year? I'm pretty sure he's going to be on Real. I think Real Madrid's going to have a 43-person roster next year. They're going to have Manu, Rudy Fernandez, Sergio. I mean, this is pretty much it for San Antonio.
Please don't tell me that you include the Lopezes in that group.
Oh, they'll both be in there, for sure. Hey, by the way, you know, one of the Lopezes was doing a live chat on Bright Side of the Sun. Did you see that?
No. Presumably
yeah.
Robin, not Brooke. Did you know that Robin Lopez used to date Michelle Wie? I totally missed that story until I was Googling doing a column on Robin Lopez the other day.
KP2, you're blowing my punchline here. This is exactly what I asked him about. So he's going through 200 comments, and everyone's like, hey, did you know you look like Sideshow Bob? Like, hey, have you tried to kill Bart Simpson yet? Like, hey, isn't Lisa Simpson pretty cute? And he's like, ha-ha, yes, ha-ha, yes. He's like going through 100 comments of these, right? And then he gets Ben from Blazers Edge who asks, hey, do you still stay in touch with Michelle Wie? And he was like, yes. You know, we still talk. Hard-hitting journalism by the SBN message boards. That's what you get. No, so I did know that. And I think that's pretty cool. I mean, it's impressive. I mean, of all the golfers at Stanford, she was obviously the best female golfer, right? And of all the Lopez basketball players, he was obviously the second best. So he was kind of, and if you want to compare apples to oranges, he was kind of out of his own league there, don't you think?
Well, I mean, the thing is, maybe she had a thing for the fro. You know, the weird thing about Google on this was I was through Robin Lopez in there, and it's got the automatic complete. And the first thing that actually came up is not Michelle Wie, it's Michelle Beadle of ESPN, who is not connected with Robin Lopez whatsoever and merely happens to have the same name as Michelle Wie. And for some reason, because of that, she's connected to him on the Internet. I don't understand.
There's probably an even deeper, darker story to that that we might want to leave untouched. Anyway, we got completely sidetracked right out of the gate. Hey, he's down now for a couple of weeks, right, Robin Lopez?
He is, yes. He has a disc injury in his lower back and will be out through at least April 12th and possibly will not be able to play in the playoffs.
Well, see, that's crazy because he's just, what, another one of this long list of Western bigs who have gone down at kind of the worst possible moment here as the playoff chase is approaching. And this is going to be a brilliant segue from killing Bart Simpson, tagging Michelle Wie, straight to Western Conference playoff chase, which is where we wanted to get. This is fantastic. So, Phoenix lost Robin Lopez for a couple weeks. So, Channing Frye, as you wrote recently, is going to have to see his minutes go up. L.A. has lost Andrew Bynum, you know, and God knows what his deal is. So, as the most recent I saw is they don't have a timeline really set for him yet, so he may or may not miss the playoffs. You would expect to get him back for the playoffs, I would hope, but you never know with these injuries. And then obviously Denver as well is limping in to the playoffs here with Kenyon Martin, who had some sketchy knee thing that they reported as one way, but apparently it could be a deeper issue and he may or may not be able to come back, he said. So that kind of totally changes the face of their team. You're going to have to play Birdman more and rely more on Nene. Obviously they don't have their coach either, but that's a different issue. So you've got three of the eight Western Conference playoff teams, if we're not counting Portland, who's lost 63 centers this season, who don't have key big men, you know, that they can plan with going into the first round. Does that change at all the makeup of the Western Conference playoff chase if you're a team like Portland, who is kind of slowly gaining ground here, pushing up from that eighth seed? I mean, are there certain teams that you have your eye on that you kind of would hope you'd be able to play? Now that they've got Marcus Camby fully integrated, he's really impacting games on both sides. He becomes a real asset in the middle. especially against a team that might not have its starting center. So is there one of those three teams that you're circling, you're kind of hoping that maybe Portland would match up with if they're going to be able to get through the first round? Or do you think, these guys are probably going to come back, it's not a huge issue, Portland should just do as well as they can and let the chips fall?
Well, what I would say actually is I think that the way it's going to impact the playoff race is that probably two of those three teams are now largely out of the picture for the Blazers. I think that, second and third are looking pretty solidly Dallas and Utah, which actually has its own injury issue with Andre Kirilenko's calf. So nobody's really healthy right now. But I think those two teams are looking pretty comfortable in second and third, especially after the Mavericks beat the Nuggets in their showdown at the American Airlines Center the other day. So the Lakers are the only team I think left in that picture, and Bynum I think is of those guys the most likely to be back for the playoffs, and I don't think that's going to be a major difference maker just because of from that standpoint. So I think that right now those are the three teams you're really looking at as far as potential matchups for the Blazers, and other than the Lakers being clear first, Dallas and Utah could finish in any order, and certainly the three teams down at the bottom in the Blazers, Oklahoma City, and San Antonio, we have no idea what kind of order they're going to finish in. So there's all sorts of possible matchups still on the table.
Okay, so LA, Dallas, or Utah, those are the three teams that we're going to say that are in play for the Blazers' first round matchup. First, second, or third, Blazers could be anywhere from sixth through eighth. Which of those three teams would you say is the most favorable for the Blazers? Which would be the least favorable for the Blazers?
Well, I think right now you'd have to say that Dallas is the most favorable matchup for the Blazers. They had a really nice win the other night, but they've lost what, 4 games in a row recently, and they've never had a very good point differential, which is why statistical analysts, most notably John Hollinger, I think was receiving death threats from Mavericks fans for a large stretch of the year because of the fact that he was talking about how poorly they'd played. So they're not real strong in our eyes, and also I think the matchups have gone well this year for the Blazers. They've shown the ability to contain Dirk Nowitzki and get some things going on the offensive end. Last Thursday was an impressive win at the Rose Garden. So I think Dallas is who you're rooting for. Utah, on the other hand, probably is the worst of those matchups based on what the two teams have done head to head and the way that the Blazers just kind of have struggled to deal with the Jazz's physicality and ability to score at the rim.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think that's sort of where the majority is leaning down here in Portland. I mean, the one thing that the Blazers have done well against Dallas is they've been able to kind of get Dallas out of a team offensive framework and kind of isolate them down to guys like Dirk or guys like Jason Terry, either doing a two-man game or in isolation one-on-one. They've been able to limit the effect of both those players, multiple times this season. Against Utah, I mean, it was like 5-on-0 practically, and it is important to keep in mind that they haven't had Camby, when they face off against Utah, so they haven't had that rim guarding or effect that Camby might have. So that might make the difference between those two teams, not seem as actually wide as it has been. But still, I mean, Dallas personnel, I think Blazers match up well. I like the idea of Andre Miller versus Jason Kidd. I don't think you lose a lot there. I don't like Dallas's bench a ton unless they do decide to finally play Boubois, who is just freaking sick. So, and I don't know why they didn't play him against Portland, which, there's a lot of second guessing going on about that on the internet. It's like, this dude, I don't understand how J.J. Barea is possibly playing minutes over Roddy Boubois. But in any case, I don't like Dallas's bench a ton. Utah's bench, where are you on Utah's bench?
It's not a strength, but it's not a major weakness. I think it's an acceptable group of reserves. I mean, Millsap, is one of the better bench players in the Western Conference, but there's just not a ton of depth that's going to be guys who are coming. When Kyle Korver is making shots, that's a big difference for them, and that was actually something we saw in that last Portland-Utah matchup. He made a huge three that helped send the game to overtime, but TJ Miles is nothing special, and the point guards, Ronnie Price, Sindiata Gaines, well, probably won't see him in the playoffs, but nothing special.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's, another thing that makes them maybe not as big of favorites over the Blazers as you might first expect is because, if their bench is basically Millsap and scraps, right? And the Blazers bench right now is basically just straight scraps. And I think that's the biggest worry that Nate McMillan's going to have going into the playoff chase is, he can count on his starting five, but everybody after that has been shaky to one degree or another. You look at Bayless, he's been up and down. Martell Webster, there's not even words to kind of describe what he's doing. I mean, he's missing shots by like 10 feet short one night. The next night, it's like 6 feet over the backboard, just all over the place. Rudy Fernandez, let's just kind of hope that he's injured, because if he's not, he barely looks like an NBA player. And Juwan Howard, I think is going to be a huge spot where teams can really work to isolate him on defense and get some pretty easy points, especially a smart team like Utah that moves the ball well. It's going to be able to attack him in that second unit. So the Blazers bench, I think, right now is going to be a big question mark coming into the playoffs. But to make up for that, their starting unit has looked awesome, and it's kind of been the opposite of what Nate McMillan had preached at the beginning of the season, which was balance between the two units. I'd say the two units on the Blazers right now are about as unbalanced as they've been in, the last couple of years. And, they're starting to look more like your traditional, playoff team might look. Like for the Lakers, for example. I mean, outside of Lamar Odom, they got some scraps too.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about the playoffs is that you can probably shorten up that rotation a little bit. Maybe Martell Webster is a guy who, depending on the matchup, you might need him against Kobe Bryant, is a defensive specialist. But if you're going up against a Utah that doesn't really get a lot of scoring from the wing, I can see him being phased out largely in favor of kind of a three-man rotation with Fernandez and Batum and Roy.
So with the Blazers being essentially tied with Oklahoma City right now, they have one more win and one more loss than the Thunder do. So they have to do a little bit of work in the loss column to pass Oklahoma City, but they have the potential to do that. We've looked on the site. Dave has looked at some the remaining schedule and which teams might have some chance for upward movement. The Blazers' next five, they're looking at the New York Knicks, at Denver, at Sacramento, at the Clippers. That's the potential, I think, right there. Really solidly to go 3-1, and perhaps you catch Denver, who may be slipping a little bit. They're only, what, 4-6 in their last 10, lost two in a row. I mean, you may be able to get them, although it's on the back-to-back. You may be able to get that one as well. So Blazers go 3-1, 4-0 there. Maybe they are able to pass Oklahoma City. What does your projection or what does your own personal analysis say about Portland being able to get into that sixth spot? Or it doesn't even make a difference.
I think looking at the two schedules, I think probably the most likely outcome is that the two teams end up tied. The Oklahoma City goes something like 6-4, 7-3 over its last 10 games. They've got some difficult, challenging games upcoming there. They got Philadelphia right now, which shouldn't be too difficult, and they're up four at the moment. But if you look at Dallas, at Boston, even on the second but back to back, at Utah, at Portland. Naturally, and even at home, they've got Denver and Phoenix still on the schedule. It's easy to see that coming into that last meeting of the season between the two teams on April 12th, on the Monday of the final week of the season, that it could be, the Thunder up by one game in the standings or something like that. And if the Blazers are able to win that game, they not only make it pretty likely, give themselves a guarantee of a tie if they win their finale against Golden State, but also win the season series 3-1 and would take the tiebreaker. On the other hand, if Oklahoma City comes in and wins that game, that would be an insurmountable two-game advantage. So it's easy to see that game deciding the sixth and seventh seed.
With Oklahoma City, after watching their recent game against the Blazers, I think that they're set up. They're a prime target to have what happened to the Blazers happen last year. Once they reach the playoffs, it's just get dismantled, not be able to execute on offense, and just become super predictable, going to Durant over and over. He's going to wear down with the defensive pressure, start settling for his outside shot, and then pretty soon I think they're going to be a pretty quick out. I'd be surprised, depending on matchups, I'd be surprised if they made it to a sixth game in the first round, just based on, what Portland was able to do to them. I mean, Jeff Green was basically a non-factor. Statistically, he was pretty similar to what LaMarcus did, but he just did not impact the game. Anytime he settles for three-pointers, it's, not good offense. Westbrook was held in check and, in some cases dominated by Andre Miller, who, is not necessarily even the best point guard in the Western Conference, but, I mean, he wasn't able to keep up. I like Westbrook's game generally, but I'm not sure if he's quite ready yet for the playoffs. And then, they've got guys like Christic and Collison who are just not going to be impact players on that level. So I think they're going to be, I think their season's going to come to a pretty quick screeching halt come playoff time. Would you agree or disagree?
I think if you look at the other game the Thunder played last weekend against the Lakers, it gives you kind of the opposite point where they just torched him in that matchup. And, the Lakers have been on cruise control the last couple of weeks. Tough to say how much Bynum's absence is a contributor or whether they're, just waiting for the playoffs to start. But, defensively, if they go, I think that the Thunder would almost benefit of going from going up against an offensive-minded team like, Phoenix, that's not a very likely matchup at this point, as we've noted. But someone like that where, they can get their offense going because it's kind of a free-flowing game, but at the same time, they'll be able to clamp down defensively and do some things that an opponent is not used to. I think that almost a half-court grinded-out game like that Portland-Oklahoma City game ended up being is almost worse for the Thunder. But yeah, I really think Andre Miller was the difference in that game. So, if they come up veteran point guard, whereas the Lakers don't have that kind of strength at the point guard position, that could be a factor in the difference between them too. And they're probably going to face a good point guard in either Jason Kidd or Deron Williams. But if they end up against Fisher, then Westbrook might be a difference maker.
So you brought up a good point. The Lakers were kind of on cruise control. So when you look at the teams like LA and Denver, maybe who aren't necessarily playing their best basketball over the last couple of weeks, is it fair to say that those teams are coasting, or would you say LA is coasting and maybe Denver's folding a little bit? Maybe they're getting exposed a little bit without Kenyon Martin. Or would you say that both of those maybe took their eye off the ball a little bit after stronger starts and they're kind of limping into the playoffs, or would
I would say much more so in Denver's case. The Lakers have a history of not, leaving something in the tank, let's put it that way, for the postseason and then kicking it up a notch. Someone pointed out that if they win 60 games this year, which I think they're a game or two away from doing, then they're going to match the 2000-2001 team, which was the last time the second of the three three-peats in 2000, 2001, 2002. So the last time they had just won their first championship. And that team had a very mediocre regular season and then a dominant postseason, went 15-1, lost only the game one against Philadelphia in the NBA Finals, and is probably the best postseason team of the last decade, maybe even ever. I mean, they were that good. So I'm not too worried about it with the Lakers. They had enough of margin for error that they could afford to cruise, but the Nuggets were still very much in the middle of the playoff race, and I think in their case it has much more to do with both Martin's absence because they basically were a three-man front court, Martin, Nene, and Chris Anderson. So now they're either playing Johan Petro, who's been starting games, and that's a dubious proposition, or Malik Allen, who is basically their Juwan Howard without the experience. So that's a big problem for them. And then also George Karl's absence, I think, has to be considered a factor in this. Adrian Dantley is learning on the job in terms of being a head coach, and he's doing it at the most critical time of the year. And who knows whether Karl is going to be able to return for the postseason, unfortunately. So I think that's a very legitimate concern in Denver's case.
Is there a single team that you would pick over the Lakers to come out of the Western Conference at this point? Is there anyone you would give a fighting chance to? I mean, I look at like Dallas against LA. I would say LA, favored by a long shot. Phoenix or LA, I would say LA favored by a long shot. Denver or LA, I would say LA favored by a long shot. But Utah versus LA, I think, the home court advantage there in Salt Lake City, plus Deron Williams, plus the overall team framework, they seem to be pretty focused, have been pretty steady throughout the entire year. I would give Utah a fighter's chance against Los Angeles if it came down to those two teams in the conference finals. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think Denver is the other team that matches up really well with them on paper. So it's just a matter of can they get healthy. And the other interesting thing in Denver is, Ty Lawson, we were all talking about how great he played in the first half of the season, and now he's barely getting off the bench behind Anthony Carter, who is a heady veteran, but still, you're looking for a spark right now. I think Ty Lawson's got to be someone you consider to be that guy.
Well, it's funny because all of this sketchy tweeting. Ty Lawson put some real weird stuff on Twitter. Not like Darrell Wright weird, but still weird. Anyway, anything else on this topic?
Well, I think just the one interesting thing for the Blazers is there is a scenario where if you feel like Dallas is a much better matchup than Utah and Dallas is going to end up as the second seed, And you have a good sense of that, where it may be better for them to finish in that seventh seed instead of in sixth. So, I mean, I can't imagine the Blazers strategically losing or, trying to get that seventh seed, but there is a scenario where that could be better for them.
Yeah, no doubt. And actually, at practice today, Nate McMillan was asked about that. Nate said, you script what he was going to say. Take one game at a time. We're trying to win every game. We don't have any injury issues that we've got to worry about. He said, the only case where he would, potentially not play to win, he said, is if, things were settled pretty much and there was an injury that he was kind of trying to work around to a key player. I think that at this point, it's probably going to be Brandon, LaMarcus, and Marcus Camby, and maybe Andre Miller would be guys, he would consider, to be quote unquote key players. But he pretty much shot down the idea of that, and it's really difficult for him to take his mindset off that. I think Nate's the kind of person who thinks that if you do that, if you do try to play for the positions, it will come back to you karmically almost, wouldn't you think? I mean, he kind of thinks like, oh, so you drop, one seed so you can play against Dallas, but then Dallas blows you out by 30 points in the first game, and so it means absolutely nothing, and you just wasted all your time and distracted your team from just trying to take care of business. That seems to be Nate McMillan's approach.
I think that's a good way to think about it. There's also, he sees a psychological aspect of it, because if you say, oh, we'd much rather play Dallas, that's bulletin board material that Rick Carlisle was going to use as a motivating factor for his team going in the playoffs. So yeah, I think that's an understandable position for Nate. I would say, by the way, that Andre Miller absolutely has to be on that list of key guys right now, because the difference between when he's on the floor and when Jared Bayless is at the point is pretty dramatic, especially on Sunday.
Yeah, well, like I said, Jared's been a little bit shaky. Well, it's just because all these bench guys, I think they're still like in this flux where, their minutes have been played with all season long, and we've talked about that ad nauseum, so we don't need to go back into it now. But now, we're kind of getting to the traditional thing where, okay, we're shortening the lineups, we're tightening up minutes. Nate's a little bit quicker with the trigger, and guys go out there and they miss a long two, maybe they miss a second long two, and that's pretty much that, and that's a totally different adjustment from, how things were even just back in February, where I was like, well, we don't even have enough healthy guys out here, so you can pretty much go out there and do whatever you want because we can't pull you because we literally cannot sub for you. And it's difficult to make those adjustments when you're a young player, and especially when the pressure's ratcheted up and, you've got older guys now in the mix who are kind of, operating on autopilot because they've been there before. I think there's a little bit of the looking around, trying to figure out exactly what's happening and what you're supposed to do. And that generally is going to lead to tentative decision making and, probably bad shot selection, which in Jared's case have kind of been two things that we've always tried to, steer him away from in our role as podcast critics. But we'll see how it goes. I mean, the thing is, like I said, none of these teams have these benches that blow you away. So, it's not like, I mean, sure, he's not nearly as good as Andre Miller, but Andre's obviously shown he can play heavy minutes and spaced out playoff schedule. He'll probably be all right. So you're really just hoping for a boost from Bayless and maybe, a defensive matchup here or there and, limiting turnovers. I mean, they're not asking him to do a ton. So hopefully, that will make his life easy in a seven-game playoff series.
And I would add to that, move the basketball, because it just seemed like the ball did not move nearly as well with the second unit in there.
Well, see, well, in fairness to Jared, though, he does move the basketball very well back and forth between his hand and the ground. The ball movement as he pounds it's fantastic. It's just not moving around the court necessarily, but it is going up and down pretty quickly.
You can turn anything into a positive. The other thing I'll point out is that Nate McMillan, this time of year in particular, is always more comfortable with veteran players. So the good news is that the veteran players now are Andre Miller and Marcus Camby, as opposed to Steve Blake and Juwan Howard.
Yeah, no kidding. Boy, how much do you miss Steve Blake and Travis Outlaw? That was a trade that just, so hard for Blazers fans to get over. And man, you really got to look over your shoulder and think, oh, that was, huge losses. Steve Blake, who's going to airball three pointers during the playoffs this year? I mean, good God, you should have seen all the hate mail I got last summer from people saying Blake wasn't ready to play in the playoffs. Well, let's see what Andre Miller does. I think he'll do a little bit better than Blake did last season. Anyway, enough Blake bashing. Let's see. Anything else on this playoff topic, or have we run this pretty much into the ground so we can get to the real meat of teams like the Indiana Pacers who are not in a playoff chase and maybe who are doing a little extra scouting of the NCAA tournament this last couple
Well,
weekends.
I was going to point out that if you're talking karma, what better than going out and trying to win all your games at the end of the season as opposed to tanking at the end of the year?
Oh, so you're going to pat yourself on the back for finally discovering Josh McRoberts after all these years of oppressing him in the system and not understanding his true raw abilities as a player. When you look at Josh McRoberts, his ceiling is what? Probably, I don't know, Patrick Ewing?
I don't even know how to respond to this, other than no silence, perhaps, I think is the only thing I can offer you.
I have a feeling you're going to come away with the top three pick. I've just got it in my gut that you're sort of like the karma, chia pet of the Indiana Pacers, like the good luck charm, and your presence is going to pull down a top three pick. Would you like to take credit for that, or would you like to, deflect that to somebody else, or would you like to no comment me because you're getting uncomfortable because we're talking about your official capacity?
I am getting uncomfortable, but I will say that there are a few things I will take credit for with regard to the Pacers in any capacity. But luck in the lottery is something I am happy to take credit for if it works out. And I will note that the Sonics came out very well in the lottery in 2007.
Indeed, that's true. Let's talk a little bit about this college tournament. Now, obviously, you're not going to tell people who your top three favorite players are, Cole Aldrich, Kyle Singler, John Shire, but you will be able to tell us which players have, maybe the high-end players, top 10, top 15 players were able to actually help their stock over the course of the NCAA tournament, and which guys maybe just stayed even, which guys maybe took a step back. My initial read on the NCAA tournament this year was, lots of upsets, obviously a lot of fun games to watch, a lot of buzzer beaters, a lot of last second, wins, overtime game. That overtime game with Xavier was incredible. So a lot of good times, but not necessarily a very instructive tournament for viewing prospects or even, trying to, gauge who was coming on strong right before the draft. It seems sort of like, a fun intramural tournament that didn't really necessarily play too much in terms of NBA importance. Is that a fair read on it? And was there anyone who really struck you as someone who helped his draft stock over the course of the last couple of weeks?
I would say that I think the Final Four is kind of representative of the tournament as a whole in that you don't have a lot of correlation between the success of these teams and NBA draft prospects. It's possible that there's not going to be a single guy in the lottery or even the top 20 picks of this year's draft out of the teams that are headed to Indianapolis. Gordon Hayward is probably considered the best draft prospect of the group, and he even might be someone who doesn't come out until 2011. So I think that, we've seen that all tournament long where guys have kind of, the guys who have been making big waves have generally been veteran players who are considered somewhat limited in terms of their NBA potential, guys like Omar Samhan, Jacob Pullen with Kansas State, Jimmer Fredette even, I think to a lesser extent maybe fits into that category. But yeah, so I think I agree with you that I think as far as the top guys, we haven't seen a whole lot either way. Wesley Johnson was someone who had a big game for Syracuse against Gonzaga, but then was not as effective, and the Orange really just didn't get him the ball down the stretch when they were losing to Butler. And we've seen things like that. The Kentucky guys had their moments certainly early in the tournament, but struggled a little bit against West Virginia in the regional final. So, I don't think anybody's gone too far up and down in terms of the lottery picks. In terms of guys maybe playing their way into the second round or improving their chances there, opening some eyes, I think that has happened, but not a huge factor either way.
So when you look at John Wall's last game as a college player, you talked about it against West Virginia. Was there a disappointment factor for you there? Were you a little surprised not to see him more forcefully take over control of that game and dictate what was going to happen? Fantastic game and a fantastic tournament, but it wasn't necessarily the transcendent performance that we had kind of hoped for from the consensus number one best player from start to finish this season.
Yeah, and I think that's just kind of the nature of the NCAA game as opposed to the NBA game. West Virginia was able to pack it in defensively. They've got a lot of length up front, even though they don't have, that one classic 7-footer or anything like that. and they basically just dared Kentucky to shoot over the top. And the only time that Wall really had a chance to, make his presence felt on the game was in the open court, and he ended up kind of forcing things, I think, in the second half just because his team was trailing and he hadn't had those opportunities. So, if you change that to an NBA setting and the floor is better spaced, you have to stay out of the lane because of 3 second defensive violation, things like that, all of a sudden it's a totally different equation for Wall. So I think that's kind of representative of the differences between the two games.
Is he the best transition point guard since Magic?
I can't think of anyone off the top of my head that's better.
Oh, that's fantastic. That should be the headline for the podcast right there. I finally got you to agree with something, a bold statement that I made. Yes. Yes. I feel vindicated here with my basketball knowledge. I completely agree with what you were saying about how he's out in transition. I mean, his ability to just, go from first to second to third gear, from third down to first, from first to fifth when he's really trying to pick it up, going across half court. His vision with the passes over the shoulders, behind the back. He makes a simple pass at the right time when he needs to, finishes with both hands, super comfortable going from right to left and finishing at the hoop with his left hand. It's just an unbelievable asset he's going to have when he makes the transition to the pro game. And that's going to be a huge question, I think, in terms of who gets that number one pick and whether they decide to keep him or whether they decide to go with Evan Turner is going to be what kind of a system do they run offensively. Because if you don't have, at least a little flexibility in terms of pushing the tempo, aren't you basically wasting the most valuable portion of John Wall? Or do you think you're going to draft John Wall and then build your offensive system around him because he's just that kind of a talent?
I'd say you're going to build your system around him. And the other thing is, it's not necessarily part of a system what he does, because it's not, he can run off of a missed shot. You got to have some guys that run with him, where DeMarcus Cousins was very good at that in the tournament, in particular at Kentucky, and getting up and down the floor and beating slower big men back. But, you don't have to game plan for that. That's just going to happen. John Wall just happens.
Well, yeah, but he's not going to just happen if he plays for the Blazers. I mean, Nate McMillan would be out there, given with cement tennis shoes, and his hands up with a giant red stop sign anytime John tried to go more than 35 miles an hour in the school zone, I mean, you can't have a super slow. If he was in a super slow system and a coach really was intent on slowing everything down, because he does make some turnovers, not necessarily always in transition, but, he does turn the ball over. And if he had a coach who was, like, harping on turnovers with him, I think you could. His ceiling comes down pretty quickly.
Yeah, even in the half court, he's going to be really good. It's like when people talk about slowing down the Suns. Well, okay, we're just going to run pick and roll with Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire, and you can try and stop that. Oh, and three great 3-point shooters in the wings.
Okay.
Great offense,
Okay.
great offense.
Fair enough. I'm just trying to find any reason to nitpick this guy because I've been obsessed with him for now, what, like 2 years now. So I'm trying to look for any possible way where he's not going to become like the next greatest player of all time. I did just compare him to Magic 2 minutes ago. Here's my question. Recuse yourself and the Pacers from this discussion. Of the other teams who are sort of in that top five mix for draft picks, who would you most like to see John Wall go play for? So you're looking at the Nets, the Timberwolves, who else is, the bottom feeders right now? Golden State,
The Utah Jazz.
the Wizards, the Jazz for the New, with the Knicks pick, I guess Detroit, maybe the LA Clippers. Of all those teams, Sacramento Kings. Of all those teams, not named Indiana, what's your ideal fit for John Wall?
New Jersey. I think I would definitely like to see him play there and revitalize, re-energize that team and potentially attract a big name free agent to come with him.
Oh, I see. Oh, boy. So you're just going to go tampering on us. Awesome. all right. That's fair enough. Okay, what about Turner?
That's a little tougher. Maybe Minnesota. I think the Minnesota would probably be the single worst fit for Wall, just with all their point guards and the triangle offense, which would seem to really stifle him. But Evan Turner operating from the wing in that offense could be really good, I think.
All right, I think that a lot of people would agree with you. How would he and Flynn fit? Is that a fit?
I'm not sure that it is. I think that I'm not sure that Flynn is a fit. I mean, I'm not sure that he's a star point guard, He's had an up and down rookie season. It's very been difficult for him because, again, they're asking him to play in that triangle, and I think that's kind of antithetical to what his skill set is in terms of creating off the dribble. But if you look at, as much as we talked about, I'm probably not as high on the you got to have guys who can play off the ball because we've seen Andre Miller and Brandon Roy make it work this year. But Flynn's not going to be very good off the ball, and Wall is certainly not going to be at his best off the ball. So I don't think that's a. I think that they would be a team that would have to try and look at making a move if they got Wall.
Well, see, that's what I think that David Kahn should do. I think he should get the draft rights to Evan Turner and then trade that for Randy Foy.
In cash.
And cash. Don't you think? That'd be perfect. It's just like Brandon Roy Part 2, right? Same thing. Just
What do
continue
you
to
think of
collect.
the Evan Turner, Brandon Roy comparisons?
I mean, there's players that Evan Turner reminds me of a lot less than Brandon Roy. I mean, I do think he's got a slightly different frame to him. Doesn't he seem a little bit bigger, a little bit
Definitely.
taller? Doesn't seem like he has quite as good of a handle. I mean, with Brandon, you really got to take into account when you're, evaluating Brandon Roy is he's really good dribbling the ball so smoothly with both hands and interchangeably back and forth either direction. There's so few players in the NBA who are that natural going both ways and, can get a shot going both ways. So I think, that's a big plus in Brandon's advantage. I like Evan Turner's rebounding abilities. He seems to show a little bit more commitment to the glass, at least on the college level, than maybe Brandon has. I've never been blown away by Brandon's rebounding abilities, but they don't ask him to do it a lot. He's always played with, some bigs that can clean some glass. So, I think that, they're fair. I think certain players, I mean, he's just the kind of person who's going to get brought up in comparisons every single year for any player who's not extraordinarily overwhelmingly athletic, but is an efficient scorer who can do multiple things with the basketball and is right around that same size. I mean, it's a pretty easy comp. I mean, there's not a lot of people you can compare to LeBron James, basically. It's like, oh yeah, it's a freight train who happens to be able to do chase down blocks and dunk from the free throw line. Like, there's just not many players who can do that. Whereas with Brandon Roy, it's like, oh yeah, they're kind of similar, He's an easier comp, is what I'm saying.
Well, I would say that I think what really reminds me of Roy when I watch Turner is he's got that kind of deliberate, controlled pace about him. I mean, you're right that he's not as good a ball handler, especially in traffic, which is explains why his turnover rate is so high. But just his ability to get where he wants to go on the floor without overwhelming athleticism. I mean, you've got guys who do that, like Tyreke Evans, who's basically like a running back with the basketball. And is just kind of bullying his way to the basket. And guys like Turner and Roy are a little bit different. They're not lightning quick. They're not Chris Paul, and they're not Tyreke Evans. They're something different, where they just have that ability to slow things down and make everybody else play at their speed and get where they want to go.
No doubt. I think that's fair enough. So which of these other prospects, these top 10 guys, do you kind of salivate over the most besides the guys we've already talked about in detail here with Wall and Turner? Obviously there's the head case Cousins, and then there's Derek Favors. Ed Davis didn't even make the tourney. You brought up Wesley Johnson earlier. Greg Monroe claims he's going to go back to college. Who knows about that? One guy who I was pretty impressed by, I liked his tournament a lot, was Patrick Patterson. What'd you think about, his impact on games? Obviously, he wasn't necessarily the number one option, but he can do a lot.
He's a solid player. His defensive rebounding is not very good right now. How much of that is DeMarcus Cousins and how much of that is his own commitment to the defensive glass is a question that is going to need to be answered. But, he's a very solid player, polished now with 3 years of experience. So he's going to be one of the more veteran players in the lottery this year, or that top half of the draft. So, yeah, solid prospect.
Okay, so outside of Wall and Turner, who really got your blood pumping?
I don't know if I would say anyone did. I will say, for the record, I thought it was a very, very disappointing performance by Kyle Singler in the regional final.
Well, it's just because you're the kind of guy who only looks at the stats and you don't really take into account how important heart and grit and intelligence and toughness and leadership and bangs and all the other things that Kyle Singler really brings to the table. I mean, sure, his shot wasn't falling. What was he, like 1 for 72 or something like that? But all those other things, I mean, Duke's not where they got to the Final Four for the first time in however many years, if not for all those things that Kyle Singler brought to the table.
You make a very convincing case, Mrs. Singler.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds like you're honestly, I know you. I know when you're trying to hide your excitement, your enthusiasm, and because you don't do a very good job out of it. And right now, I'm going to say that you are not excited at all about this NBA draft class whatsoever. You sound way less excited than last year.
I would say the one difference from last year is I don't think that there's those one or two guys that. Last year it was Lawson and it was Blair who you could say, oh, I think that there's a really good chance that those guys are going to be steals. There's some people out there that I think are better than they've been given credit for being, but also now this year it's not a matter of broadcasting those to the world.
All right, well, since you're not excited about the NBA draft, KP2, I know you are excited about the NBA playoffs. Right now, just to bring this full circle to the beginning of the discussion, it sounds like you had either LA or Utah coming out of the Western Conference. Gun to your head, who makes the finals from the Western Conference?
I would still say the Lakers.
And Eastern Conference, Cleveland or bust?
I mean, I think Orlando is right there, the way they played in the month of March. I think that's going to be, barring something unforeseen, and Boston and Atlanta, have the ability to make it, pull an upset, but I think that's going to be a phenomenal Eastern Conference Finals rematch, and I think Orlando might just come out again.
All right, so gun to your head, finals matchup, you're saying Orlando versus LA, a rematch from last season, and you have LA winning again?
No, I would have Orlando win. I think whoever comes out of the East will win it. I think Cleveland versus Orlando is the real finals at this point.
Very interesting. Well, beginning of the season, I said Cleveland over LA, right?
I think I said Orlando over LA at the beginning of the season, so
Well, very
there you
good.
go.
So nothing has changed at all. All of these hours that we spent podcasting, hours we spent writing about the NBA had absolutely no impact whatsoever, and it's exactly where we were back in September.
Just a complete waste.
It was a complete waste. Well, that about sums up this episode of the Wingcast. Talk to you next week, KP2. Hope everything is going well.
All right, later.
More serious, so killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, my own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer. Come straight to the